and Nystrom. Nystrom's really getting some good right hands in.
Gillies is down with Sandstrom. Somebody better help Sandstrom.
Everyone must be held accountable for their actions.
You cannot see your star carried out in a stretcher and do nothing about it.
Oh, my. Did Mick plant one on C-card? Wow.
You can't put a bounty on a man's head.
I just did.
Yeah, that's exactly what we should do. Run him up and fill him in.
Then why don't you?
The kids don't want it. They don't skate. They don't score. They don't hit. They don't fight. They float.
They don't love to win.
They don't hate to lose.
Spinning. Who's he going to go after? The puck drops and Bob Gardner goes right to King Flattenburg.
But just a minute, Al Arbor has won four Stanley Cups, so don't start telling Al Arbor what to do, you and John Davison.
Take care of Mason Tucker. Here's Lance Carlson.
This is Coliseum Chronicles, The Penalty Box, your source for Islanders Enforcer Talk. Proud member of the Hockey Podcast Network, and I'm your host, Joe Lazzito. And welcome to episode 149. Getting it out a little bit late here today. Sorry about that, folks. I hope you people understand. This is the final installment of the Lost episodes, and tonight my guest is John Forslund, the legendary broadcaster who cut his teeth with the Springfield Indians, and that really is the focus of this interview. But others may know him as the voice of the Hartford Whalers or the Carolina Hurricanes or now the Seattle Kraken. John, absolute legend. It was an honor to really sit down with him and get some of his stories about the former Springfield Indians, get a story about how he got his start. And it's, I say it with these episodes, it's hard to listen to because not that I am using the greatest technology nowadays, but man, when I think back to that, the laptop I was using was, I think, from the 40s, and it was about 37 pounds. And we actually did the interview in person at the Marriott Hotel. And again, not great technology. I'll apologize for it now if you haven't listened to it yet when it was first uploaded years ago. But in spite of the technology, John was an unbelievable guest, and he's got some great stories about all the tough guys who went through Springfield, whether or not they ended up on Long Island as well. So if you're an Islanders fan, tough guy fan, I think you'll really enjoy this. And John was unbelievable. So it's pretty cool when you could get someone who's one of the best of all time at his craft, and absolute legend, and a really classy gentleman as well. But before we get to that episode, if you are on social media, the links to my social media accounts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram are in the show notes of this very episode, along with the link to Islanders A to Z, the children's book illustrated by Mighty Joe Marisich, the artist who designed the logo for this very podcast. If you have an art project that needs to get done and needs to get done by the best, I tell you, go right now to Twitter, punch in Graphics Joker, where you have that little search bar on Twitter, or go to loudegg.com, reach out to Joe, tell him that I sent you. I believe you get a 0% discount, but you know that might vary, but Joe's amazing. No matter what the cost is, you get it done, and you get it done by the best. Now, the Hockey Podcast Network, great network. Happy to be a part of it now for a little bit, and happy that they still have me here. Every team has at least one show dedicated to it. I am on the original content side with folks like Terry Ryan, Rod Peterson, and of course, my old pal, Darren, from Saskatchewan, the OG, the fourth line voice. Latest episode number 367. 367 episodes. Can you believe that? It's a solo episode. Probably my favorite episodes that he does. And this episode, he talks about, I got it right here, destroying a grade one classroom. That's his wife's class. Steve Simmons, it's just another thing with these writers, the holier-than-thou attitudes, like the Steve Simmons and Damian Cox and other guy. I always forget his name. I can't remember, but yeah, just the same bullshit you get with these fucking people. They all seem to be around Toronto also. I wonder how that happens. Darren goes over some hate mail he's received, which I got a big-time chuckle out of. And I believe it's courtesy of our old pal Yuka, the sweet Swede himself, stumbled over my words there, supplied Darren with the list, the top five all-time European enforcers. And that is a legitimate list. I know you might be laughing, but that is a legitimate list. There are some pretty good names on that list. Of course, Bob Nystrom, born in Sweden, did not make the list because he was raised in Western Canada. But I'm still putting him number one. I'm still putting him number one. He's born in Sweden, and but he was not on that list. But it is a pretty good list. There's a couple of real tough guys on that list. So definitely give the Fourth Line Voice podcast a listen, and also follow his YouTube channel, also named the Fourth Line Voice YouTube channel, because chances are, if you've watched the hockey fight on YouTube, it was on the Fourth Line Voice YouTube channel. Still want to give some shout outs here, to a couple of shows. Five for Fighting podcast, rest in peace, Alec. You know, I've gone over the struggles he's had with the East Coast Hockey League, and he's finally put it to bed here. But don't sleep on the episodes he put out. There's some really good ones out there. So, definitely check out the back catalog. To be honest with you, his back catalog and the episodes that he's uploaded are pretty much better than most of the stuff that's out there now. So definitely check out the back catalog. And also Jordan, five in a game, not quite sure what's going on there, but he has not, as far as I know, it is still an active show. Maybe there's just family stuff going on, or he's just focusing on his family, one or the other. And he hasn't really had time to put anything out. So, just to recap, Fourth Line Voice, active, current episodes, two a week, inactive, the Five for Fighting podcast, but check out the back catalog as well as the Five in a Game podcast, which may or may not still be active. But while we're trying to find out, check out his back catalog too. So, this episode, as I said, it's the last of the lost episodes with John Forslund, and I'm not going to do much more of an intro than this, because next week will be episode 150, which is a milestone, which I always find funny, because why is episode 150 better than episode 151? I know, you know, as humans, we like the round numbers and everything, so I get that, but I always get a chuckle out of that, like, you're married 50 years, and it's a big deal, which, of course, it is a big deal, well, especially nowadays. You probably have to have three couples combined to get married 50 years. But so it's a big thing when you're married 50 years. But when you're married 53 years, no big deal. But it's actually a bigger deal than 50. So, like I said, I get it that we like the round numbers. But and I was kind of wondering what should I do for the 150th episode, and should I interview somebody? And then something happened, a good thing, a really, really good thing happened. And I'm basically, it'll be a solo episode. I'm going to recount a recent road trip that my oldest son and I took. And, you know, I'll let the cat out of the bag here. We did an OHL road trip. We saw four games in four different OHL barns. We finished it up, of course, with the Sabres dummying the Islanders in Buffalo. But the road trip itself was phenomenal. I mean, I just drive around aimlessly. If I could drive around with my son, you know, for a week, I don't care. You know, I'm all about my family. And to have the opportunity to take this road trip with my son was amazing. And we saw some really good games, ran into some old friends that you will all know when I tell you their names. And basically, I'll go I'll go stop by stop with you and talk about a few things. And I think it'll be a pretty good episode. I think if you're someone who appreciates hockey, maybe go out of your comfort zone a little bit. Maybe comfort zone isn't the right word, but go out of your local rinks or whatever. And especially if you're a dad, you know, mom or dad, because, you know, like Andrea, you know, she's a hockey mom. I not the get up at 4:30 in the morning hockey mom, but she loves hockey and she loves her kids. And not so, you know, she's not so much with, say, junior hockey or the minors, mostly the Islanders. But you get an opportunity to do something like this, like I did with my son, and visit some new places, and you know, just introduce him to some old friends, and eat a lot of poutine along the way. Yeah, that was damn. It's such a simple concept, what it takes to make poutine, yet it's just genius. But anyway, I'm going to start drooling here like Homer in the GIF. But so next week, episode 150, you know, it's important to me, milestone episode. I love every guest I've had, but not as much as my son, obviously. And it was just such a fun time. So I don't really want to talk too much about anything else, because I kind of feel like once the motor gets running here, I may just bring something up, and I don't want to. So I'd rather talk about it all in one episode. And I don't know if he'll come on here with me, but maybe I'll see if the young lad wants to hop on here and we can discuss it together. But if not, it'll be a solo episode detailing our fantastic trip through Ontario. Obviously, OHL road trip. Oh, I guess it's not obvious because there are some U.S. teams, but it was OHL in Ontario, and it was amazing. So that'll be next week, along with I've gone through all the box scores for Bridgeport. I got a list of all the Bridgeport fights this year. It's actually more than I expected. More than I expected for nowadays. It's not like I wasn't blown away with the totals, but they're blowing away the parent club in terms of fighting. So I will have that. I'll have the updated New York Islanders and Bridgeport Islanders fight report for you, and then I'll just basically talk about the trip that we just took, and it was so much fun. But anyway, I won't talk about that anymore. So after these commercial messages, it's the Lost episode with John Forsland again. Apologies for the technology there. And if you can get through the whatever it is, the hum, or I forget what it was. I just know when those episodes are hard to listen to. But this is the last episode that, for whatever reason, did not last on the platform. So there'll be no more Lost episodes. And then now I can kind of focus on getting some new guest for the show, and onward and upward. So I hope you people have a great week, and I'll talk to you next Monday. See ya. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code THPN. New customers can bet $5 to get $200 instantly in bonus bets only on DraftKings Sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/football for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Eric Laxdal and Jeff Rolichek, Sean Evans, and Wayne McBean on defense. Evans retreats. 2 minutes remaining on the try power play. He sweeps across for Greg Parks, who slams it in. McBean has the rebound. McBean behind the net. Top of your screen for Evans. Inside for Parks. Holding that disc. Here's McBean. Closing. Shooting. And scoring! The Springfield Indians have won the Calder Cup!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Coliseum Chronicles, the Penalty Box. I'm your host, Joe Lizzito. Today, it is an honor, and I don't say that lightly. It is an absolute honor to be speaking to the man I've admired for many years. I'm here today with the voice of the Carolina Hurricanes, Mr. John Forslund. I originally became familiar with John from a show called Ringside, a great, great American Hockey League show. I was an AHL fan at that point, but it was really just the back of the hockey news or end of the year stats. But Ringside actually brought American Hockey League highlights into my living room. And because Springfield Indians, which were the Islanders minor league team at the time, were on local television in Springfield, every episode was chock full of Indian highlights. So as I said, this is a big deal for me. John Forslund, welcome to the Penalty Box.
Thanks, Joe. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's an honor. So we're going to handle this interview two parts. We're going to talk a little bit about John's career, and then we're going to talk about some of the guys that he covered with the Indians. And as much as I want to hear about your career, you're the guy to talk to about these guys. So I'm sure you have some good stories.
Yeah, finally.
So when did you know that you wanted to be a broadcaster? I actually wanted to do your job growing up.
That's cool.
But I didn't want to put in the work because as a 16 and 17-year-old, I knew everything there was to know. So I didn't want to do high school sports or college sports. I figured I'd go to college, get my degree, and then, of course, the Islanders were going to hire me because I knew so much.
Right.
So I didn't realize all the work that went into it, which is another reason why I admire someone that's achieved what you've achieved so much, is I know what goes into it. So when did you first realize that you wanted to pursue this?
Well, my first recollection of anything was in 1970. So I was 8 years old when the Bruins won the Stanley Cup. And when Bobby Orr scored that famous goal, leaping through the air, I guess that's where I got the bug to maybe call games, because Dan Kelly was the announcer on CBS Mother's Day. I was watching it by myself at my aunt's house, and the rest of the family were elsewhere in the house. And I vividly remember that Sunday afternoon. But I remember his cadence, and I got hooked, and I guess I developed a hobby. Minor league team in Springfield. We were fans. We went to all the games. They were every Friday and Saturday night. Loved the teams. In 1971, they won the Calder Cup with Butch Goring being a key figure, and Billy Smith in goal. But I started honing my craft at that age. Around 12, I got a tape recorder. I did the games off the television. I figured out how I was going to get my notes and prepare. I wasn't a great reader. My mom suggested, you need to read more. I hated reading, so she said, read about hockey. And I played baseball and in high school and through college and that, and all the other football, basketball, neighborhood sports and all that. But it wasn't that I was a hockey player. I was a fan, and I was hooked by announcing it. I don't know why. So I would do games off the TV. My dad would do color for me. His buddies would come and have a beverage or two, watch the Bruins. Every game was on television. We had a parabolic antenna that could bring the games in from Boston. And I developed a style. And I used to do this, and my closest friends knew that I wanted to do this and would encourage me, but I always felt that, there's no chance I'll ever do this. And when I was in high school, I kind of threw it by my guidance counselor, and she told me that it was a pie-in-the-sky type dream job. Do something. You can have that dream, but you better get something as a fallback, and that's kind of the direction I went in college. But college buddies encouraged me to take a course, which I did, and then that guy there kind of pointed me in the right direction, told me I had some talent, and then I believed him. And then I got a chance to work in the minor leagues, and then the rest is history, I guess. But that's how it all came about.
That's awesome. So my question that I'm going to try to stump you with, since you brought up the Bruins.
Yeah.
You're a Springfield kid.
Yeah.
That's Bruins country.
Right.
Who's the second best Bruin of all time? Because obviously if I said who's the best Bruin of all time, everyone's going to say Bobby Orr. Someone who's a lifelong hockey guy.
Yeah.
Even if it's someone that maybe numbers-wise isn't the best. Who's, like for me, my Islanders.
Yeah.
My number one Islander of all time, I think, is Dennis Popp.
Uh-huh.
And if you ask me who my number two was, I would probably say Brian Trotty.
Yeah.
So who's your number two Bruin?
Well, you have to understand that by 1984, I disconnected.
Okay.
Okay, because even when I worked for Springfield, the Islanders became my team.
Right, okay.
Because I had the affiliation was there, but I knew so many guys, and Mr. Torrey was so good to me, and Darcy, and Mr. Harbour, and all this. So they were my team, and the days of being a fan were gone. So I'll take it from, you know, 69 to 84.
Right.
And I think the most emotional I ever became as a young boy was when Phil was traded, when Esposito was traded to the Rangers.
Yeah.
And I threw my street hockey stick through a bay window of a neighbor's house.
Is that right?
Yeah, my dad drove by and rolled down the window and said, they traded Esposito. And I said, to who? He goes, the Rangers.
Oh.
And then he drove down the hill to where our house was. I took my stick and fired it like a boomerang. The thing went around and around and went right through a bay window, which I had a bay.
Oh, my goodness.
Our friends, they were good about it and everything. But I was emotional about that. I was a big Phil Esposito fan. Terry O'Reilly. Mm. But I think central to all of it was Jerry Cheevers.
Yeah.
I think Jerry Cheevers is a Hall of Fame goalie, but he often gets overlooked when they talk about great goalies. And he was a phenomenal goalie because he played behind some teams, a lot like Grant Fuhr did, that liked to have a good time,
yeah,
and played a little bit loosey-goosey. And I've always felt, and I worked with Mike Milbury the other night, and he agreed with this, like the Bruins should have won 4 or 5 consecutive Stanley Cups if they didn't have such a good time.
Yeah.
And so they won in 70, they won in 72. But then they had those upsets and those years where they stumbled and the Flyers got the best of them in 74 and 75. But they were a terrific team. So I would say Jerry Cheevers. I really enjoyed the mask.
Yeah.
I enjoyed everything about him. Mm-hmm. And he was a money goalie like Billy Smith.
The good part about your story is I'm sure the neighbor's window who the stick went through probably understood completely why you did it.
Not really.
Oh, no?
No, they weren't really. Espo fans? I think they liked me before Espo.
Okay.
I like to think that I was a nice kid.
Yeah.
And they understood why I was upset, but they, yeah, you know, mom and dad were angry.
Yeah.
I got grounded for about a week, and we paid it back and all that. But anyway, that was a great moment in history.
I figured they put the arm around you and go,
yeah,
I'm not happy you did it, but I understand why.
No.
Okay.
No.
So you're a Springfield kid.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of people that are listening to this live in major league cities,
mm-hmm,
but they don't live in minor league cities.
Mm-hmm.
So growing up, even before you worked for the team.
Right.
How important is having a team like the, I guess, the Kings at one point,
yeah,
and the Indians? How important is having a team like that for the community?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and a lot of people haven't asked that. And so I think growing up in a minor league town gave me an understanding for how the game works. So back in those days, they used to sell the hockey news as a vending item, mm-hmm, with popcorn peanuts, and they used to actually yell it out, hockey news. And my dad would buy it for me, and I would read it cover to cover. But I loved reading about the secondary leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned about the junior system. I learned all of this stuff as a teenager. So I had kind of a built-in knowledge when I went to work at it.
Yeah.
And then another thing happened too, in 84, 85, when I was an intern, before they hired me full-time in Springfield, the project I had to work on was the 50th anniversary team of the Springfield Indians / Kings, okay? And I was aware of all this.
Yeah.
And I just went at it with all my heart and soul, and I think I did a really good job with it. I had to get the guys in, I had to coordinate the balloting, I had to do the big night, they'd let me host it on the ice. You know, there's a lot of things there. If I didn't grow up in Springfield, I wouldn't have known.
Right.
And I worked with somebody at the time who moved on, and he was from St. Louis, and all he knew was the National Hockey League because he was a Blues fan.
Mm-hmm.
He had no idea how any of this worked. So I saw a lot of guys come up, a lot of guys come down, went through the World Hockey Association and how that almost put the AHL out of business.
Yeah.
And so I understood the framework of how the business worked. And so then when I had a chance to like interview people like Emil Francis and things like that when I was working in the American Hockey League, I had a historical perspective of where they were in their careers and how it all happened.
Yeah.
And I remember the cat, after the interview was over, said, how do you have any idea who any of these guys were? Well, because my mom told me to read. I read all the Fischler books.
Mm-hmm.
I read everything that had anything to do with hockey. The libraries, that's where I would go. And then I paid attention, and I knew how the system worked. I think that helped me. I think that helped me a lot.
It's funny because you say that, and I talk about nowadays. My wife calls me a cranky old man because I always say back in the day.
Yeah.
But like you say, talking about the back of the hockey news where you're reading the stats and everything,
yeah,
the juniors and the minors, I love doing that stuff. Like,
oh, yeah,
I love putting the work in. Mm-hmm. Every week you get the hockey news, and like I said, I knew about the Springfield Indians, I knew about the American League, but it was pretty much at that point just words on a page before,
right,
I was able to watch ringside.
Right.
But I love doing the research. I absolutely love doing that. So I think we're similar in that respect.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're around the same age, so we're the same generation, basically.
Right.
So I totally understand what you're talking
about. Yeah, because there was a mystique to it.
Yeah.
And like in the old Pacific League, Central League,
yeah.
Dallas against Tulsa, yep. mm-hmm. and all these things. It was like, wow, what is this? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so I think we came from a different era where everything wasn't known, mm-hmm. and you had to really dig.
Yeah.
And it left a lot to the imagination.
I love doing that. Like, I remember when they had the team in Indianapolis, when they had the Checkers. But I was a little bit younger.
Yeah.
And really, when I got to age where I was, like, voracious about it, was really when they put the full affiliation in Springfield. Well, they split it with Minnesota for a bit.
Right.
And when they completely went there, that was, like, my ripe age for, like, just I couldn't get enough.
Right.
So I totally understand what you're saying. So you do have some Long Island ties. You did do some college work here at Adelphi.
How did that
come about?
So I was wondering how I was going to go from I was a physical education major at Springfield College and wanted to coach in high school, and how I was going to take this experience broadcasting and also maybe work in pro sports. And in 1983, sports management had just become kind of a new field. Obviously intriguing because of the glamour maybe attached to it, which doesn't exist, but that's what a lot of people thought. I'm a sports fan, I want to work in sports, and I was driving a lot of people that direction. So anyway, I went to a convention in Providence. A guy named Gary Barrett was in the athletic department of Adelphi University, and he was there. And he just met me and interviewed me, and he said, you know, we have a position you might be interested in. You can come down, it's an assistantship if you qualify, your grades are good enough. You can go to school nights, and you can work at St. Paul's School in Garden City. And it was a boys' school, and you can coach a little bit there. They need some help in the athletic department, and I did. So I coached football, I coached baseball. I did a year there. I lived there. I lived in Garden City, dry for 5 years, and went to school at Adelphi. And then I got to, it's funny because I had it really helped because this is before I worked for Springfield.
Yeah.
So then when I went to Springfield and worked for them and they had an affiliation with the Islanders, I already had knowledge of the area.
Right.
And I kind of, you know, it was kind of a romantic thing for me maybe, but also with the kids, you know, I knew, you know, where they were going, you know, the Holiday Inn, the Old Country Road, all those things, right? I knew all these things because I'd already lived it. So I loved living here. It was short. I almost stayed here. Like, they offered me a job.
Mm-hmm.
But then my internship popped with the Indians, and thankfully it did.
So that was my next question. How did you end up hooking up with the Indians?
Well, I just had an in. Actually, my sister knew a secretary that worked for the American Hockey League. And she knew Peter Cooney, who's the owner of the team, and he was looking for some office help.
Mm-hmm.
So college intern was something that he was open to because he didn't have to pay him an extra set of hands. So I went and met Pete. And when I sat down with Peter, who's become a big, big influence in my life, and he's my agent today and all this stuff, we sat over lunch, and he said, do you have any broadcasting experience? And I said, oh, yeah, tons. And he never asked me if I worked for anybody, if I had a tape or anything. He said, good, because, you know, it's part of your internship. Just work with my guy I have. He's brand new. He's a little green. You can do color for him at the home games. We'll see where it goes. And I said, all right, terrific. So anyway, I was referring to me and my dad as my experience and whatever impersonations I used to do, whatever kind of stuff I used to do to kind of entertain the boys at college parties off the television. Anyway, he gave me a chance to do that, and then he hired me, and I worked there for 7 years.
So I know, I have a lot of friends who've worked for minor league teams, be it hockey or baseball, and I know whether you're an intern or a full-time worker, your title is strictly a title. Your title is one hat, but you probably wear 10.
Yeah.
So what were some of the things you did? Like, people know you as the voice of the Indians.
Yeah.
But what were some of the other duties that you had there with the Indians that aren't necessarily aren't so glamorous? Like, I think you did PR for them also.
Yeah,
you were
the
PR director.
I did everything. I did PR, I did group sales, I did ad sales, I did whatever kind of marketing it was back in those days. I wrote the program. I did all the game notes. In those days, it was a typewriter, and then it became a word processor. You know, but it was still archaic. We had four people in the front office. There was a business manager. There was Peter, who's hands-on. He's there every day. There's Bruce Lannon, who's a general manager. There was me. Mm-hmm. And then there was a part-time person who worked in group sales, and she sold group sales on the side, and she was kind of a quasi-full/part-time person. So anyway, that was the front office. So yes, I did everything.
Yeah.
The first thing I ever did for the team was there was a hot dog restaurant called Zab's, and anyway, they were giving away free hot dogs, and I had a rubber stamp the back of every ticket.
Is that right?
For opening night, which was 7,449 tickets, but maybe 4,000 people came, but every ticket had to have a stamp, and there was not a machine for this, it was me. Mm-hmm. It took me all day, and that's all I did. I just kept stamping the tickets, the first thing I ever did.
Yeah.
But I did all kinds of stuff, manual labor for the team, all the travel. It gave me a tremendous amount of experience that I could use later on when I got to the National Hockey League.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest thing was that Pete sat me down one day and said, tell me about your broadcasting philosophy. And I went through all this crap, and then I said, you know, this is how I prepare, and I put a lot of time into it. He said, stop right there. I don't care.
Yeah.
And he was a former announcer himself. And I said, what do you mean you don't care? He said, that's the bottom of the list, man. You can be the best broadcaster ever. If you don't do these other jobs and do them well, you're not going to work here. And one of those was selling. And I hated it. I hated ad sales. But I had to go out and try and generate some sponsorships for the team. Mm-hmm. And then I might have an hour to prep for my game, which was important to me, but not in terms of where he looked at it.
Right, right. That's tremendous. It's good because it seems like your answers are so amazing. They just go one into the other of my questions. So talking about all the duties you had, in 1988-89, you won the Ken McKenzie Award.
Yeah.
And this award honors the individual who accomplished the most during the season in promoting his or her AHL team. So, yeah. I mean, you just went through all your duties.
Yeah.
So it's no surprise.
You know, I was flattered by that because a lot of guys who had won that previous to me had already gone on to broadcasting careers in the NHL. That's where I wanted to go. I thought that would really help me. I remember when they told me about it, they brought me to the league meetings in Portland, Maine, and I got the award there. It was nice. But, I mean, that is just a byproduct of passion.
Yeah.
I had no idea that was going to happen. I had no idea I was doing anything right. I love my job. I still love my job. I love hockey. That's it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why those things happen.
So, like I mentioned to you before we started recording, one of my favorite parts about doing this is doing the research. And as an announcer, most announcers who are established have catchphrases.
Yeah.
And you have a bunch of them, but I think the one you're most known for is the "Hey, hey, what do you say?"
Yeah.
And I had obviously known that for years.
Yeah.
But up until a few years ago, I never knew where that originated from. And I think it's a great story. So could you tell us where that came from?
Sure. So it's a tribute to my dad, who died in 1985. He died on January 12th, 1985. And, again, he was my best friend. I got married in 86. He was going to be my best man. And he was my color guy when I was growing up. And he used to say that. And so he used to just say it when he met you or if he's coaching kids baseball or whatever. He would say, hey, what do you say? So when he died, it was the first day I got a paycheck. And I came home from the game. We played Rochester that night. I went out with my fiance. And we went out in the town. I came home. She was sleeping over the house. And she went down the basement. I went to my room. And anyway, I was awakened around 5, 6 in the morning by my mom. My dad's an aorta burst. He died suddenly. And I gave him CPR and everything. I went to Springfield College with PE, so I was certified then. Mm-hmm. And so I lived with that guilt. I thought I should have saved his life. I didn't. It took me about 2 years to reconcile where I was going. I almost didn't get married. I really had a tough time with that.
Yeah.
And I was on buses a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking a lot.
You had time to think. Yeah. You're by yourself.
I was thinking a lot. And then you go have a few beers, mm-hmm. and you go down a road there that could really lead you in a bad spot.
Mm-hmm.
And so, why did this happen? I was 22, taking care of my mom. My mom was old school. She didn't know where the money was. She didn't know how to do a checkbook. She didn't do a lot of things. I took over a lot. And I was going to get married, in 86, and we ended up doing it and all that. But anyway, it was on a trip either to Hershey or Baltimore. I know we were going south.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, I'm going to use the phrase tonight. There's a big goal.
Yeah.
And I did. And it was just a tribute to him. And then as time marched on, I figured out, I'm going to use it when I think the game's over.
Yeah.
And I did. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the team won the Calder Cup in 90 that a reporter asked me, what is this?
Oh,
and I told a story.
Oh, wow.
And in the Springfield Daily News, they wrote a piece on the Hey, Hey, What Do You Say?
Yeah.
And so I kept it, and I did it. And then in Hartford, when I first got the job and people get used to me, fans, they don't know.
Yeah.
And writers, the media critics, they would call it hokey. And I just took it.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't say, hey, it's because of my dad. Until somebody asked me again.
Right.
And then I said it. So, yes, it's a local broadcast thing. I don't use it on NBC because it would show favoritism,
right.
But it's strictly for the Canes now. When I think the game's in the books, I use it, but it's always a tribute to him.
Well, the most important thing in my life is my kids. I love being a father, so yeah, I love that story.
Me too.
I love it.
Yeah.
So, obviously, once you do this for a living, you may not have a favorite broadcaster. But even growing up, was there one guy who was your like? I had told you, like, I love Mike Emmerich. I love Jiggs McDonald.
Yeah.
Did you have someone that you loved to listen to?
Yeah. Well, I would say originally Dan Kelly,
mm-hmm.
and then from Dan Kelly, Fred Cusick,
mm-hmm.
who did the Bruins
yeah.
for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older, I think the guy, Jiggs and Barry Landers.
Yeah.
Barry Landers was good to me.
Yeah, Barry he was the radio voice of the Islanders, if you're too young to remember.
Yeah, Barry Landers was really a great man, mm-hmm. and was very good to me.
Yeah.
And they gave me a couple chances to come up and do radio with him. And Jiggs was first class,
yeah.
and still is to this day. When I get a nice comment from Jiggs, it really means an awful lot. And I watched him do Butchie's ceremony last week.
Yeah.
It was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's just an unbelievable hockey man, unbelievable talent. And so that was different because I was working, and Jiggs was what I wanted to get to, you know. And he knew that, and he was always encouraging. So he has a special place in my heart, too. Mm-hmm. But I would say those are the guys. And I think for whatever reason, I tell young announcers this today, and this came to me by accident. I didn't really try to be somebody.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a mistake in our business because whoever that is already done that.
Yeah.
So if there's somebody out there that likes what I do, and a couple of the young guys in the league have said that, I've always said that I'm really flattered, but please do it your own way because I've already done that.
Yeah.
And I didn't try to do what Dan Kelly did, but that came by accident.
Yeah.
It just happened. So I think that happened for a reason.
I tell people, you know, like, one of the things I was going to say to you, but I'll say it to you now because we brought up Jiggs. For someone like me who was raised on Islander hockey, my Islander memories are all narrated by Jiggs McDonald.
Yeah.
So for you, that has to be a pretty cool feeling knowing that the hockey that you introduced to the people in North Carolina, you're the narrator. All the memories they have,
right,
are narrated by you.
Right.
That has to be a pretty cool feeling.
That's the best feeling.
Yeah.
And it blows away any national recognition. It's the reward. And I've always said because it's Carolina, it's different because it was brand new.
Yeah.
And so if you're the voice of the Leafs, you're just carrying on a legacy.
Right.
If you're the voice of the Hurricanes, you're starting from ground zero.
Yeah.
And so when I went to Hartford originally, I was just coming in after Rick Peckham.
Yeah.
And the Whalers kind of had this flashes of this and flashes of that and some not good stuff. And it was just kind of being a steward.
Yeah.
Whereas with the Hurricanes, you're kind of like, you know, you're on the ground floor.
Yeah.
So it's totally different. And it's something I always think about when there's potential change maybe.
Yeah.
Is like, you know, do you really want to change after all this time?
Right.
It's a long time that I've been there.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, we've had, you know, there since Jiggs, there was Howie Rose, and now we have Brendan Burke and everything. But I like romanticize things, so all of my memories are older.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it's just, I know, like, to me, Jiggs is royalty.
Yeah.
You know, he is just royalty, and I'm happy that, obviously, people in Springfield will always remember your voice.
Yeah.
But now you have a larger audience.
Yeah.
You know, you have all of the North Carolina and everything, and I guess if they put the games in South Carolina, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And even now with satellite.
Right.
But
that's
for
the
those,
other thing.
Yeah, for those fans down there, you know, there's probably 30-year-old men and women now that say, oh man, I remember John said this, I remember, and then there's 5-year-olds right now that 10 years from now are going to say, man, my first memory is this goal and the way that John described it. So I'm happy for you.
I can't tell you the joy you get from that.
Yeah,
when
that's
people
amazing.
Tell you that, it's an amazing reward for this.
So you've done both play-by-play and color commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Which do you prefer?
Play-by-play.
Play-by-play?
Yeah.
Is there a reason why?
I just love it. I mean, to me, it's just, again, you're carrying the cadence of the sport. And I think hockey play-by-play is different than anything else because your voice can carry the emotion of the play.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in the other room and you hear, you know, my voice start to go up, you should understand there's probably a chance coming here. There's a scoring chance or something like that. So I think there's a, there's a romantic side to it. And you know what? Color was good because I could fill in the blanks, but there's only so far I could go as not being an ex-player.
Right.
So ex-players have a big time advantage because they've been in those shoes.
Yep.
And I think that's the best thing as far as a real good analyst is somebody who's been in the shoes, who can forecast something before you see it. Because we all can watch it.
Yep.
And we all can regurgitate what we just saw.
Mm-hmm.
But the real good analysts in all sports today forecast something before it happens.
And along those lines, you've also done both television and radio.
Yeah.
So obviously, for television, I'm watching the game and hearing you describe it. But on the radio, whether I'm in my car or like we talked about with Barry Landers, when I was a kid, there were years we didn't have cable.
Right.
So I'm in my mom's bedroom listening to the stereo, Barry Landers and John Potvin, they're describing the game to me.
Right.
I can't see it.
Right.
Which did you prefer? Which do you prefer?
If everything's even?
Yeah, like money-wise, everything is even, radio, television.
Radio.
I knew you were going to say
everything's
that.
Even,
yeah.
Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved doing the conference finals last year, radio only,
in
the Raleigh market.
Mm-hmm.
So after I did the Islanders series for NBC, first round Tampa, Columbus, Carolina, Washington, did that for NBC. Now, conference final, I did our local games on radio. It's tremendous because you're really painting a picture. It's raw. It's true broadcasting.
Yeah.
Television is great. It's different because it's your producer, director, it's a whole bunch of people that make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
In itself, it's really rewarding because it's more of a team.
Right.
Radio is just you
and
your partner, but it's really just you.
Right.
You're painting, you can say anything.
Yeah.
Whereas in television, there's an art to it. If it's done correctly, you're saying something, but you're playing off the visuals.
Right.
And you're interpreting a graphic so that you're adding a little bit more to the graphic than just reading the graphic.
Right.
And there's an art to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
They're both rewarding.
Right.
But if everything's even, there's nothing like doing radio.
And I would think most guys in your position would probably say the same thing. Because I think for someone who's achieved as much as you've achieved, it's not a job, it's not a career, it's a passion.
Right.
And I think if you have the passion for it, you like telling that story.
Yeah.
That's what I would think.
Absolutely.
So, is it true that you once had a tussle with the Sherbrooke Canadiens mascot?
That's exactly right.
Well, how did that go down?
So, I mean, I try to be a nice guy and respectful, but we're in the sports palace, Palais des Sports, and the playoff game. And it's the same year, I believe, that Mike Milbury had an issue with the organist in that place. The organist used to play, they had a player, Steve Tajura.
Yep.
Remember him?
Yep.
And so he was a really good player, Canadian-born, Japanese descent, I think he was.
Yep.
So every time he came on the ice, they played Japanese music on the organ.
I didn't know that.
And Mike went berserk.
Yeah.
And it was a small rink, about 3,000 seats, so he had to go up about 20 rows. And he left the bench, he went up 20 rows, and he got into a tussle with the organist in that same season.
Made
the hockey news.
Yeah.
My thing happened in the playoffs. This thing that looked like the Expos mascot, what the Canadians use now, whoopee type guy, sat down on my little perch there in that little box. It was like an enclosed box that they gave us to announce games from. And I couldn't see the corner. I couldn't see the goalie. I couldn't see down to my right.
Yeah.
I asked him once, please move. I asked him twice, please move. And then the third time, he gave me a little gesture. And I'm calling the game, and I couldn't see. And the fans started, taunting me and everything.
Oh.
So I got mad, and I punched him.
Yeah.
He went down, the security came. This is in the middle of the game.
I was going to say, this is all during the game.
Middle of the playoff game. And I kind of said what happened, and I'm not standing for it.
Yeah.
And the tribe's here to win, and all kinds of things. Anyway, I wish I had the tape of that.
That would be amazing.
But that is a true story,
So as I told you, I did reach out to some former Indians, try to get some John Forslund stories. And to your credit, all to a man, they all love you. And they said, basically, I think Vern Smith summed it up, said he was too smart, he stayed away from us. But Vern Smith did tell me to ask you about one thing. The Arby's promo that he did with your nephew. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, he said ask you about that.
Yeah, I think, my nephew was like, we did a photo shoot with Smitty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my nephew was about 8 years old, and
he was the
subject, I guess.
Yep.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
There you go. Good, I'm glad. I'm glad that made you smile.
Yeah.
So, before we get to the individual Indians, I have to ask you about the wildest thing I had ever seen for Springfield. And obviously, you have seen a lot more than I did.
I know where you're going.
So, if this is not the craziest thing, then let me know.
Yeah.
But, and thankfully for YouTube, everybody can see this now. I'm talking about the brawl between Springfield and Fredericton. So first, is this the craziest thing you had ever seen as the voice of the Indians?
Bar none.
Yeah, okay.
Bar none.
Right.
So look at the head coaches that were involved in that. Claude Julien, Mark Crawford, Todd McClellan, Bruce Boudreau were all players at the time.
Yep.
Ron LaPointe and Gordy Lane started it in the alley between the two benches, the two coaches. It went on for 20 minutes. There were four or five Pier 6 brawls.
Yep.
It wouldn't stop. It's ugly. Guys' heads were split open. One of the best goalie fights ever between Marty Wakelin and Ron Tugnutt.
Yep.
And I called it and went berserk.
Yeah.
And it's my voice before puberty. So it lives now on YouTube.
Yeah.
1987.
Yeah.
And Gordy got suspended for 5 games. We lost all 5 games after that fight. And then Gordy Lane came back. And he was eligible to come back after the fifth game. The loss was in Glens Falls.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing a post-game show. And as I'm doing the post-game show, I see our guys coming back on the ice. And Gordy had a practice after the game. And so I did the post-game show, and I said, the Indians are coming back on the ice. I packed up. I watched them practice for an hour.
Wow.
We went to the locker room. He had a around-the-ring type discussion with every player, had to say what was wrong with the team.
Yeah.
We got out of there like at 1 in the morning, went to the hotel. Drove the next day to Sherbrooke, and there's a fork in the road, and I'm in charge of the travel. You go to the left, you go to Montreal. You go to the right, you go to Sherbrooke. And so the bus is going, and he starts to go to the left.
Yeah.
And I'm like, sir,
yeah,
he's French. I'm like, we're going the wrong way here. And he's like, no. And I said, Gordy, Sherbrooke's over there.
Yeah.
We're headed toward Montreal now. And Gordy, you know, in his way, just said, you know, relax. And he took the boys out at night out of the town.
Oh, that was nice.
In the Montreal. Barbie barn for dinner.
Yeah.
A little bar scene afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Sherbrooke. And then they won 7-2.
Nice.
And he was a great guy.
I know when I had interviewed Mick, we talked about Gordy.
Yeah.
And we talked about when Mick had played with the Islanders his first game when he got faked out by Tiger Williams.
Yeah.
And Tiger went and scored the goal.
Yeah.
And then he said when he went back to Springfield, he said Gordy taught him a lesson.
Yes.
And, you know, I just hear the reverence in his voice about Gordy. And, I mean, on the island, we love Gordy.
Yeah.
You know, you love the guy. So I'm not surprised to hear the story like you tell and hear the stories that the ex-players have.
Yeah.
So, before one more question before we get to the individual guys. So one of the coolest things about the Islanders being affiliated with Springfield and you guys being on TV a lot was when you guys won the Cup, 89-90, I think a week later, they broadcast the game here on Long Island. And not only did they broadcast the game, they broadcast the entire post-game celebration. So we saw
all
the interviews. I mean, everything was, I still have it on VHS at home.
Right.
I have the whole thing. And that was so much fun. So before we talk about the individual players, just talk about that season and the road to the Calder Cup and ultimately winning the Calder Cup. I mean, obviously, for myself, especially someone like you, Jeff Rolichek,
yeah.
I mean, he's...
Yeah.
I mean, what... Just
well,
talk about the culmination.
Like, I never knew scored until afterwards.
Yeah.
Okay, because there was no announcement made.
Right.
And it was a tip. I thought McBean had the goal, but... yeah, so that season was not supposed to happen because the team wasn't very good in the front half of the year, and Jimmy Roberts was frustrated. And I think I have the Super Bowl correct because I think it was the year Buffalo lost
to the Giants.
To the Giants,
unfortunately.
Unfortunately, which I hate to
imagine. Salt on the wound.
So was it, that was wide right, I think.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Yes, it was. Unfortunately.
So Jimmy and I are in a sports bar in Baltimore. And it's a Sunday afternoon. We played in Hershey the night before. We didn't play the Skipjacks until Tuesday.
Okay.
So we had a practice day on Monday, so we had a free day.
Mm-hmm.
So Jimmy and I went out to a sports bar, and it was just he and I, very few people there, watching the Super Bowl. And he had put me in his golf club, had a box type thing for the Super Bowl, the numbers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we put in some money. Anyway, we won.
Oh, okay.
So we won a couple $1,000s.
Oh, nice.
It was a big thing, and anyway, we were happy and all this. We watched the game, and then Jimmy said, we're going to make the playoffs. And I think the team was at least 20 points out of a playoff spot in January.
Okay.
Go Bills!
And they made...
That's right.
they made a trade. And what they did was they traded Bruce Boudreau. And Bruce was a very popular player and a signed free agent for Springfield specifically.
Yeah.
And we had really marketed this guy a lot. He was a night form. He was like the Crash Davis of hockey.
Yeah.
So we made a trade, and we got Paul Gagne, Derek Laxdal, Jack Capuano from the Newmarket Saints for Bruce Boudreau. That trade, Cappy didn't play much, but Gagne and Laxdal did. They changed the dynamic of the team. Hackett got red hot. The team had great chemistry, great individuals. Tommy Fitzgerald, Mark Bergevin. I mean, this was a Dahlman, Kushner. This team had character through and through. Robbie DeMaio. Anyway, they started winning and winning and winning. They won one game in Utica against Tommy McBee's Devils. They trailed 6-1 going into the third period and won 7-6 in regulation. They scored a goal every other minute. That's the biggest, best comeback I can remember. Mm-hmm. And then they went to the playoffs. No one gave them a chance right until the end against Rochester, who was a talent-laden team with a lot of money dumped into it. They flew. Buffalo flew them. Springfield in the final round. We had two buses. And so it was a storybook.
Yeah.
And it was also a year that Springfield was rumored to leave.
Yeah.
And I remember going in that overtime. You recall the call of that. I said that, you know, this could be it.
Yeah.
And we didn't know what the future was. I didn't know if Cooney was pulling the plug on the team or what was going to happen. And they won. And then the next year they followed up with a different affiliate and won it again.
Yeah.
But the 90 team was spectacular. Yeah. Spectacular.
So now we're going to talk about some of the old Indians from the Islanders affiliations. So you can answer with one word or 20 minutes.
Okay.
It's your call.
Okay.
And I'm to not show any favoritism, I'm doing it alphabetically.
Great. Okay.
Bob Bassin.
Bobby Bassin was so serious, such a hard worker. You know, there was a mystique about kids that came from Western Canada. It was like, you know, they were tougher. They had the longer bus rides. He was all hockey. He was a terrific, I just think of the word diligence. He was a diligent worker and respectful. He was respectful to me,
Sean Byram.
Byram was a character, just like this kid that came off the farm, happy-go-lucky, the brunt of many jokes, took them well, big, strong kid. Didn't develop into what they probably thought he would be, another Jethro, be another Clark Gillies. I know what they were looking for, it just didn't happen for him. His son's a remarkable player, he's going to have a great NHL future. But he was a lot of fun to be around.
A guy who you only were affiliated with for a short period of time, because he joined the team late, I believe, Kevin Cheveldayoff.
Yeah, and he was injured.
Yeah.
He had a significant knee problem. Really curtailed his career.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but Chevy was, again, the Islanders, Bill, Tex Eamon, Earl Ingerfield, they, Burt Marshall, they might not always have got the best players, they got the best people.
Yeah.
They drafted character.
Yeah.
Like, it was all character. Mm-hmm. And it was sometimes frustrating for Jimmy Roberts at the end there, because he wanted a little bit more talent.
Yeah.
But we didn't have a lot of skill. They had tremendous character.
Yeah.
And Chevy's that.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's been neat to... He didn't do much in Springfield, but I remember him well because of his size, and he's just a big, strong kid. And then his management career has been fantastic. So I love seeing him, and I wish him all the best.
I mean, I say this, you know, like for Islander fans of a certain age, we had the... three first-round picks in a row was Dean Chenal, Cheveldayoff, and Chizowski.
Yeah.
And I think on the surface, some people say, well, they were busts.
Yeah.
Some people say that. And I say, well, I don't think so. And
no.
I say, if you look at where they came from in junior and what their role was then and what their roles were here, if you just look at numbers, and I think a lot of fans are guilty of that, where they just look at the numbers, they don't look at intangibles, they don't look at other things, where, you know, Chevy's case, it was injuries, okay? And with Chyzowski, I think they may have rushed him too soon.
They did.
Okay. But with someone like Dino, who's my next guy that I'm going to ask you about, when he played, he was solid.
Yeah.
Okay. And as far as a coach goes, like you talk about the way they drafted guys, Sheveldayoff is an amazing general manager, and Dean Chenault is one of the top coaches.
Yeah.
I mean, so these are hockey intelligent guys.
That's right.
So, like I always say, well, you could say what you want, but you're wrong. And like I said, you had two drafts in a row where you have arguably one of the best general managers in the league.
Yeah.
And if you look at Dean Chenault, he went right from playing to coaching, and he's been in different leagues, and he's always successful.
Right. You have to remember, for the fans, that this isn't easy.
Yeah.
And when you have identity, it's hard to attain.
Yeah.
It's easy to lose.
Yeah.
And the Islanders had identity and then lost it.
Yeah.
And they lost it because they panicked.
Mm.
Because when they were great, there's going to be a price for being great drafting-wise.
Mm.
You're not getting the Trottiers, the Pop fans. I mean, they had to be bad to get those guys.
Yeah.
And so, but they were still drafting the same type of character people.
Absolutely.
And that was the key, and that's what we saw. Dino's one of those people.
Yeah.
And Dino, you know, had this understanding of the game from his dad, knew how it worked,
knew
it had a bunch of talent, stood up for his teammates, loved life. It's the same person today.
Yeah.
The same person, only with different life experiences and a coaching resume now. Really smart. He's got that big smile.
Yep.
He loves life, and that's what I remember. I remember when I see him and I see him laugh.
Yeah.
I remember him when he laughed as a kid back in
1987. Yeah.
So that's what I see today.
Now I love him. He's one of my favorite people.
Great man.
Absolutely, I love him. Kerry Clark.
Old Sharky. That was the Moonwalker. Fantastic. You know, tough hole to be placed in when you're Wendell's your brother.
Yeah.
Wendell Clark was a rock star.
Yep.
Wendell Clark was John, Paul, Ringo, George, all of them, all four of them in Toronto.
Yep.
And in those days, boy, because, you know, we didn't have a lot of exposure, when you were that big as an icon in the National Hockey League, you were probably larger than you actually were.
Yep.
And so Wendell was Wendell. He's known by his first name, right?
Yep.
And there's Kerry, Wendell's brother. So I always had that. But he fought so many battles for his teammates. Again, was a caring guy. Stepped up for me when I asked him to do things in the community. Always did. Loved playing, and had the guts to do that moonwalk, which I encouraged him to do.
Yeah.
And he could back it up.
And
he had some of the best fights with Kenny Baumgartner. I tell you what, they were titanic matches.
Yep.
They were great fights.
And for people who've listened to my previous episodes, that's a name that always comes up with a lot of these guys that I interview, because they came from the Western League, they came from the American League, is Ken Baumgartner.
Yeah.
And I think people that saw him maybe towards the end of his career where he was still effective, they really don't understand just how the word that everyone uses is terrorized.
Oh.
He terrorized the Western League, he terrorized the American League.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a force. And for Islander fans lucky enough like myself to have seen that, saw his tenure here.
Yeah.
He was unbelievable,
was.
You know, so for guys to stand up to him and, you know, not be intimidated, like you say, Sharky, he wasn't intimidated by anybody, you know, so I'm pretty sure that him and Wendell probably had a couple of bouts when they were kids.
Sure they did.
In Kelvington, so.
Sure they did.
Well, this is sort of a loaded name, since I now found out he's your agent, but I know Peter Cooney is synonymous with the Springfield Indians.
Yeah.
So just talk a little bit about Peter.
Great influence in my life. Confidant, mentor when I was younger, and then after he sold the team, he decided to get in the agent business. But the thing about Peter is, you know, he's very successful, he has some wealth, and he didn't have to go into the agent business. He could have done something else, or he could have just, you know, rested on some laurels and figured something else out. But he wanted to work in hockey again, and he wanted to go to bat for the underdog. So if you look at the clients he's taken on, Andrew McDonald, fans here will be familiar with, Joel Ward, Trevor Gilley.
I was just going to say, Trevor Gilley, Trevor Gilley's agent. We're very familiar with him.
Right, Michael Haley.
Today.
I mean, you go through the list of kids he represents. This Connor Garland in Arizona, who's a 20-goal scorer. They're not the can't-missers.
Yep.
You know, they go to Don Meehan and the Bobby Orr group and all of that. He takes lower level, he takes ECHL kids, He gives him a chance, and he goes to work for him. And basically, he just came to me and said, you know what, if I can help you, I'll help you. This was way back in the 90s. And today, we have a great relationship. He works on my behalf. Luckily, I'm at a stage in my career where my work kind of says it.
Yeah.
So he just, I just have him verify everything as we go along. But he was a great owner. He was an old schooler. He cared for the players.
Yeah.
Some of the players probably didn't like how frugal he was at times. Yeah. But when he had to step up in the playoffs, he bought more team dinners. He treated those players correctly when they were winners. And we had sensational runs to Calder Cups.
Yeah, Trevor Gillies, we spoke about Peter a few times. I know how high regard he holds him and how much he loves him. So, someone who was a teammate of Ken Baumgartner's and Prince Albert, Rod Dahlman.
Yeah, Dolly was a gamer. And again, I say it over and over again. One thing that I'm really grateful for in those years is how respectful the guys were towards me, and they didn't have to be.
Yeah.
But they all were, and Dolly was one of those guys. And the tougher they were, it seemed like the more respectful they were. But he played the game in a way that it wasn't just the fighting.
Yeah.
You know, he went to the net hard. He paid a price. He was injured. He was a borderliner. He could have played.
Yeah.
He could have played. He could have had a longer NHL career. I really believe that.
A lot of the guys, especially someone like Mick Vokoda, who they were very close, he says if he was a couple inches taller, 10, 15 pounds heavier, he would have been a force in the NHL for 10 years.
Because he would have scored more. Mm-hmm. He'd have been like Cam Neely.
Yeah.
He would have been able to score, and then he would have been able to afford himself more space because of his toughness. And then the hands and everything, you know, that's what happened with Neely.
Yeah.
You know, he becomes a great goal scorer.
Exactly.
But he was a tough guy.
Oh, yeah. Again, Neely, Tockett, all those guys.
Yeah, they get space.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Gerald Didick.
Diddy was interesting. He was, he always kept me honest. He was, I had to work hard with him because he kind of questioned maybe, you know, what I was all about.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was really smart, and he had a stinging wit about him.
Yeah.
But he became a good friend, and then we worked together in the National Hockey League. You know, he came to Hartford, and it kind of what goes around comes around kind of worked there. But I remember him being very, very in tune with everything around the game.
Yeah.
So he was the union guy. He was the guy that knew, you know, he was always making sure the per diem was right. He was always making sure that nobody was getting wronged along the way. He was the union steward. He was one of those types that had his back up against management all the time because he was so intelligent. But a good player.
Yeah, he had a great career. Solid career.
Very good NHL. Yeah.
The captain, Sal, Robbie DeMaio.
Best. Really great. Pound for pound, the toughest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Would fight anybody at his size. Again, undying worker. Amazing. You know, it's funny. He went on to just continue to improve.
Yeah.
A couple things happened for him. The Tampa situation that furthered his career. A lot of things happened. But in Springfield, he was a great leader. I have memories of him, you know, his face being mangled on the bus, nose being pushed over to one side, playing the next night, never took a night off, played hard all the time, and a great person, good friend today.
Yeah. My first experience with him, watching him live, was a game here, and he fought Al Secord when Al Secord was with Toronto. And I was like, I didn't know, like I said, at that time it was pretty much the numbers in the back of the hockey game.
Yeah.
And I didn't know much about him, and I'm like, who's this little guy fighting Al Secord?
Yeah.
You know, and then you get to know the player a little bit, and he's more established, and then a couple years later, he's going toe-to-toe with a prime Darren Kimball.
Yeah.
And I'm going, man, this guy, I just love this guy. Yeah. I mean, I'm always partial to Italian heritage also, so I love him, but
we called him Sal.
I mean, he's just the guy, I think he's one of the guys that when I bring his name up to anybody, they smile.
Yeah.
You just have to smile.
You have to.
A total warrior.
Yeah, he's a great captain. Great captain.
Going a little old school, Gordy Dineen.
Yeah, Gordy, that was very early in my career. So Gordy was an up and downer, mostly in the National Hockey League. So his brother Kevin I had more of a relationship with. But Gordy was, when Gordy came to Springfield, he was already a guy kind of up and down.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a presence about him. That's what I remember about Gordy.
Dean Ewan.
Ooh. Yeah. another incredibly tough individual, maybe to a fault, but the quiet.
Yeah.
He was a lot more quiet than Kushner, Dahlman, Robbie, even Mick. Mick would talk a lot.
Yeah.
Dean was very reserved, I remember, but a lot of respect there.
Dale Henry.
Oh, the Colonel.
A prominent figure in the Fredericton brawl.
Yes, with Jacques Mayotte, headbutt.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jacques put the thing around, there's like the spirit of 76.
Yes.
The Colonel was a good man and an old schooler.
Yeah.
And probably should have played in the 50s.
Yeah.
But he was smart.
Yeah.
He was a smart player. Mm-hmm. And he was tough.
Yeah.
So Saskatoon Blades, I think, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he was tough, but he was also... had some hockey sense, so he could get around the rink and know where to go to score the big goal. He scored some big goals. And Jimmy Roberts loved him. He really did.
The Moose, Glenn Johannesson.
Oh, the Moose.
Who sounds European, but isn't.
Yeah, he is.
Didn't play that way.
Western Michigan?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. He was a beauty.
Yeah.
He couldn't get out of his own way. he was just a happy-go-lucky kid.
Yeah.
Probably put his foot in his mouth more than once.
Mm-hmm.
He was the brunt of some jokes. He was good to me.
Yeah.
He was good to me, and he was a big, imposing guy from what I remember. But that was in my first couple of years.
Yeah.
With Moose. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Remember him? Yeah.
Alan Kerr.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Now there's a guy. He's definitely playing today.
Yeah.
A lot.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
He probably needed just a little bit more size. Shoulders weren't great. Good goal scorer. Smart kid, good kid. I was wrong about him. I thought he was going to really make it.
Yeah.
I thought he was really going to make it. A couple times he got called up. I remember conversations with Darcy Regeer, and I really, more than not, luckily in my career, I've been right.
Mm-hmm.
I see him enough, and you're around him every day. I really thought he was going to really cut it here for a long time. He had a little bit of a career in the National Hockey League, but I thought it could have been better.
The guy you mentioned earlier, Dale Kushner.
Yeah, he was a wild man.
Yeah,
he was wild, and he fought everybody. He again brought a ton of that Islander character. They just had too many of those guys. That stuff got ahead of his game.
Yeah.
I think that curtailed his career.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a wild man.
Yeah,
that I remember.
Guy we talked about briefly, Gordie Lane.
Gordy was great.
Yeah.
Gordy, I knew, was watching him as a fan. Then I had to work hand-in-hand with him as a coach. You know, he's got the speech impediment. He went through an awful lot in his career. He's very smart.
Mm.
I know what the Islanders and what Bill loved him like a son.
Yeah.
Really tried to help him. He knew the game inside and out. He was just frustrated by the lack of talent he had on the team at the time,
right.
The newness of coaching, and he couldn't stand to lose. And I think he didn't know how to put losing in a compartment. At some point, Joe, coaches have to, they hate losing, but they have to recognize that sometimes the losing is just part of what they do, and they have to know how to take the losing and make it a winning environment.
Right.
The only way to go through that is to lose.
Right.
And a lot of guys can't reconcile it, and Gordy could not reconcile losing. It was getting in the way of him progressing as a coach. It was frustrating him the next day. It would linger in the next day. Couldn't make the next day better because he hadn't gotten over the game before.
Right.
But he was the first-class guy.
Yeah.
And treated me very, very well, and I like Gordy a lot.
With another guy we briefly touched on, you talked about the trade, was Derek Laxdal, the Train.
Yeah, the big Train.
Mm-hmm.
Good player. Had a great, good career. Going to be a good coach. He is a good coach.
Yeah.
But he was a thinker, and I think he and Paul Gagne, that's why that trade made such a difference, because I remember Jimmy Roberts, who was one of the most influential people in my life, miss him every day, but he would talk about hockey sense. I had no idea what he was talking about, but he had an idea of who was smart and who wasn't, and Derek was a smart player that had a nose for the net and scored some huge goals that year.
Yeah, which probably explains, actually we talked about him when I just interviewed Brent Severn, who does TV work for Dallas, and now you know Derek is a coach there now. And, we basically said he's done all he can do as far as coaching in the minors.
Right.
There's really nothing left for him to do.
Right.
So this is the natural progression, and it's only a matter of time before he's a full-time head coach in the NHL.
I think he will be.
Yeah.
I think he will be. He was a perfect demeanor for it.
Someone I talk about with everybody, I'm actually honored to call his mother a friend, is Duncan McPherson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tragedy.
Yeah. And great kid. And he was wholesome.
Yeah.
And it's just a shame. And then all of that happened. And there's nothing anybody could do at the time.
Right.
And I never got to know his parents. I watched all the video on it after years afterward and everything. Yeah. But he loved life. He too had some real knee troubles that stunted his growth as a player.
Yeah.
He had all kinds of potential.
Mm-hmm. One guy who I didn't see much of, and he was probably there towards the beginning of your tenure there, maybe the middle, and there's not a lot out there to read about him, is a guy named Mike Neal.
Yeah, Mike Neal.
Wow, even you don't see
him. Yeah, I picked him number three.
Yeah.
Quiet,
yeah.
Good-looking kid,
mm-hmm.
had a lot of potential. Never realized. I just don't think he had the burn.
Yeah,
from what I remember, mm-hmm. I don't think he had that internal drive a lot of these guys did. You know, get the miles ticker was unbelievable.
Yeah,
yeah.
Another guy that is has a hockey pedigree, hockey family like Dean Ewen and Kerry Clark is Gordon Patton.
Yeah, Gordy was a quiet guy. You know, John, his brother, you know, Westerner again. We had so many Western people and you know, like a cowboy type. He's like a cowboy type. And I saw something on the internet with Gordy Paddock recently. He's in the Hall of Fame for baseball.
Yes, yes.
He became a youth baseball coach and like a huge Canadian baseball coach.
That's right.
Amateur
ranks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I never knew that because I would have talked to him a lot about baseball back in those days, but he was very quiet.
Yeah.
He was a steady player.
One guy who I slipped my mind when we were talking about Chevy and Dino as far as hockey intelligence and an executive type role, Chris Pryor takes a backseat to nobody.
Oh, man. Sarge.
Yeah.
He's great.
Yeah.
One of my favorite people.
Yeah.
Another one, if you look at him, probably don't like him just looking at him because he's intimidating.
Yeah.
He looks so serious. There's a teddy bear inside.
Yep.
You got to get to know him.
Mm-hmm.
Real smart.
Yeah.
New people could size you up, figure you out, stood up for his teammates, limited a little bit on the ice, always felt he was being wronged by the North Stars, always felt he was being wronged by the Islanders. He was probably right in some ways.
Yeah.
But look what he did with his career. He's a great scout, assistant general manager, hockey through and through, and he's a great friend.
Yeah,
we're still in touch.
I love him.
Yeah.
I love him. I should probably get comfortable because the next guy on my list is someone who everybody smiles about, Jimmy Roberts.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Next to my father, that's the one guy that had a big influence. So the profession. So my dad, as a male role model, molded me as a man. Jimmy molded me as a hockey person. Everything I know today, I attribute to Jimmy.
Yeah.
Because Jimmy, I was a sponge. Jimmy taught me everything I needed to know, taught me about the old days with the Canadiens, taught me about systems, taught me about how he ran practices, listened to me, and I was like, what do you listen to me for? Like, he would ask me opinions on players and games. He said, why? Because you see it from a totally different perspective, and I like what you say. And we had these conversations. We became very close. He helped me get the National League job. We stayed in touch over the years. Just a wonderful guy. And he was hard on his players, but his players loved him.
Yeah.
Most of them.
Yeah.
Some guys probably still, you know, he did a tough thing like for Dean Chenault when he scratched him for the final game of the Calder Cup. Mm-hmm. After he played 17 games, game 18, he took him out. And he told me that morning, I told Dino this, just the other night we were talking about it, and I don't know if he believes me or not, but Jimmy called me and he said, Chenault's coming out. I said, why? He was coming out, Hank Lammon was going in. He said, and Johnny, mark my words, he'll make the National Hockey League because of this. If I don't do this, he might not have a chance. He's too uncomfortable.
Wow.
And so I was like, okay. And so he did, and I think he held it against Jimmy for a number of years. I don't know where he is with that. Players don't reconcile these things,
right,
no matter what happens in their lives.
Right.
So anyway, Jimmy was remarkable. He was just a wonderful man, and I'll never forget some of the lessons I learned. I don't think I would be able to do what I do today if not for him.
Yeah.
I mean, he means that much to me.
With people with Springfield ties, I always ask him about Duncan, and I always ask him about Jimmy. And then one of the people that I spoke to recently was Jamie Rivers.
Yeah.
And Jamie had Jimmy as a coach in Worcester and in St. Louis.
Yeah.
And just you just hear how people talk about him with such reverence. Yeah. And like you said, how, you know, just a role model, male role model. Everybody loves this man.
Right. So you remember Sean Evans?
Yeah.
So Sean now is a junior A coach in Truro, Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. You talk about a small world. So he's been coaching that team, the Bearcats, where Andrew McDonald played for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy had a big effect on his life. Jimmy needed just his life off the ice.
Yeah.
He needed to become a better person.
Yeah, I remember this. Yep.
He battled alcoholism. Mm-hmm. He got through it. He became a tremendous American League player.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of a cup of coffee in the NHL and Europe and so on. But anyway, he devoted his life to coaching. So Jimmy was like a father to him.
Yeah.
Okay? So my son, and it's a long story I don't have to get into, but ended up making his team and playing junior A hockey in Truro, just outside Halifax, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me one day and he said, "Dad, we just had the Jimmy Roberts practice." And I said, "What?" He goes, "The Jimmy Roberts practice. The kids come in," and Sean's done this for years.
Mm-hmm.
"They come into practice one day a year and there's a pamphlet in their stall and it's Jimmy's biography.
Oh, yeah.
And they have to read about Jimmy Roberts. And then Sean puts on the wool gloves and the hat and runs the practice where they don't, like Jimmy used to do no puck scrimmages.
Mm-hmm.
You play without a puck."
Yeah.
"And you can do whatever you want. Goalies are making saves and guys are scoring at the same time."
Yeah.
"They don't have a puck."
Yeah.
And anyway, he teaches them a few things about Jimmy. And I just thought that was a small world type thing where my kid ended up playing there for him.
Yeah.
And then the Jimmy Roberts thing came around the band. It was kind of strange.
That's a great thing about hockey, though, because I think I can't speak for the other sports, even though I'm a baseball fan, I'm a football fan. But in terms of hockey, it always seems like there's a lot of those things
there
where
is.
if you're someone like Jimmy who has influenced so many people,
yeah,
you're always going to come back around.
Yeah.
And now let's say your son was going to go on to do something in hockey,
right,
especially at a coaching level, 15, 20 years from now,
right,
he may be doing a Jimmy Roberts practice.
Well, I'll tell you what, because he's on a path that might lead him down that road,
yep,
he'll be on, Sean Evans would be the guy.
Yeah.
Because he says that's the best guy he ever played for.
Right.
And he's taken all those experiences because they ran their team so well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the college he's at now, he's like, "We don't even have a culture close to what we had in Truro."
Right.
He said, "And I'd like to run a team someday that has that." And that all came from Jimmy.
Yeah.
Which came from the Montreal Canadiens.
Right.
So it's like, you know, you're right about that.
Yeah, it's awesome. The guy we talked about already, Vern Smith.
Yeah, Smitty was great.
Yeah.
He and still is. And so he settled there. He settled in that area of the country, and good-looking guy,
yeah,
a lot of talent. I bet you he plays today.
Yeah.
I bet you he would have played today because I think he was just viewed, he wasn't afraid to mix it up.
Yeah.
But I think they viewed him then as maybe because of his size, he had pretty good size.
Yeah.
And, you know, he should have been a little bit tougher.
Yeah.
But he could move the puck, mm-hmm, and he could make a first pass really well. He was a really, again, a respectful guy. I mean, I don't, you know, the memories I have of these guys, the way they treated me,
yeah,
is all first class.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't get ribbed. I wasn't looked at as an outcast. I could have been. I was just, mm-hmm, the announcer for the team. They were good to me. Smitty was front and center. He was excellent.
Another guy with the hockey pedigree, the kid brother, Mike Stevens.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, the cat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a good player.
Yeah.
He could put it all together.
Yeah.
But he was quiet,
mm-hmm,
and he had the glasses, and he was a little bit more introspective than most, so he was a little bit different that way, but it was good to be around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if we saved the best for last or the most colorful for last. Mick Vokoda.
Yeah, Mick was... Mick was special for all the reasons the fans remember.
Yeah.
But Mick was, for me, a go-to person because he would help me in the locker room with other guys. If I needed guys to do things, he would hang out and help Johnny out.
Yep.
He was the first guy to do community stuff with me.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to go to the hospital with somebody. Mick came. Mick did everything. When he came here, he did everything.
Yep.
It didn't change. So whatever the PR department asked him to do, he did.
Yep.
And he was so understated and so gentle for such a guy that was a terror.
Yeah.
An absolute terror. He had pretty good hands for his size.
Yeah.
But he is a, I wish him nothing but the best because he paid a price.
Yeah.
He paid a price to do what he did. But I can't reinforce Joe enough about how nice he was to people.
Yeah.
How nice and genuine he was with the fans, booster club parties.
Yep.
He was loved.
Yeah.
And then when he got here, it didn't change.
No.
And so it got even better.
Yep.
He was the same person. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's ever changed.
No, he's the same goofy kid he was in Springfield.
I don't think he's ever changed.
No.
And I was a 24 or 5 year old guy trying to work in this business, and I had a lot of demands I would ask the players to do, or interviews and stuff like that that would help me, and it wasn't easy.
Yeah.
And it wasn't at a time like we have today where, you know, they might not be as nice today, some of the kids, but they recognize because it's a business, they
right.
have to do these things.
Right.
Back then, they were nicer,
yep.
but they didn't have to do it.
Exactly.
I'm not going to do it. Talking to your tape recorder, you're nuts, man.
Yep.
You know, I'd go to Mick, I'd say, give me a pride. Give me one interview this year because he doesn't want to do it.
And yeah.
Troy, would you help Johnny up?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was that guy for me. Wonderful.
I think he's that guy for a lot of guys. When, obviously, I mentioned, you know, Dean Ewan was my first
yeah.
interview. He's basically, he's a brother to me.
Yeah.
And we talked about when he played with Mick in Spokane.
Yeah.
And just about, I mean, this you're talking about his locker room presence in
yeah.
Springfield.
Yeah.
This is how he was back then, where
yeah.
he just, we talk about, you know, some guys are quiet, some guys are this, but Mick, no matter what his role was with the team,
yeah.
he could command the locker room.
Right.
You know, and even, you know, Mick told the story about the game against Pittsburgh, where they won in overtime in
yeah.
the playoffs, where he said something in the locker room.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's in there with guys like Pierre Turgeon
yeah.
and guys like that, but he just has this presence about him. And it's not anything where, you know, like these are all grown men. Nobody's afraid he's going to beat them up.
No.
It's just, it's a respect thing.
Yeah.
And whether he's in Spokane or in Springfield or here on the island, he just always had, there are some guys that have it
yeah.
and some guys don't.
Well,
and
you
he
know,
had it.
Yeah, like a story, you know, I'm sure the details aren't completely right here, but I do have a recollection of this. We had a big community thing we had to do on a Monday morning at a hospital. And boys knew about it, but they would always forget,
yeah.
no matter how many times I reminded them. And we were coming back from a long road trip, and we got back, and we had lost like 2 or 3, 4 in a row, whatever it was, and it was a miserable environment. And I was afraid. I was afraid to have to go back the bus
yeah.
and say, guys, I need 4 of you tomorrow morning.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you remember.
Yeah.
I'm going to look bad. My owner's going to get mad. I might get fired. Now I got to convince him. And I remember coming back, and Mick just had his head down. And he picked up his head, and I was standing there, and he looked at me and goes, I remember. And I said, okay, so we're good. On 3 other guys are with me. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Get back up to the front of the bus. Okay.
Yeah. That is just,
yeah.
that's the guy I know.
Yeah.
That's him.
Yeah.
So I'm not,
and then
definitely
that's gold.
Not surprised.
That's
yeah.
gold.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that's why when he made it,
mm-hmm.
I was such a fan. And then when he made it, and it was about the same time that I made it up here in my role,
mm-hmm.
then I would see him, and he never forgot. He hugged me.
Yeah.
And they're all like that.
Yeah.
Very lucky.
A lot of the guys I asked you about came from the West.
They all came from the West.
A lot of them came from the West. It's just those old school values and
yeah.
You know, family values.
And that's what Bill wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
Bill Torrey's greatest attribute among many was the fact he could read people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He could read players, he could read people. And again, they paid a price because they were committed to the same philosophy. They never changed.
Yeah.
And they were so good for so long, they weren't getting the best.
Yeah.
But they were getting the right ones, they thought.
Yeah.
And he leaned on Tex Eamon a lot.
Yeah.
It was all coming from one area of the world at the time. And then they had the Derek Kings and Dal Garnos and those people. They were OHLers. They didn't have the same fabric
no.
of those kids out there. They
no.
really didn't.
No.
Really
definitely not. No, and it's funny. I think if you're from up there,
yeah.
you know it. And actually, one of the things that's funny is they used to hear, I don't know if you were familiar with it, they used to do a Heels and Flats
yeah.
show. I don't
yeah.
know if you ever saw
yeah.
that. And then one day it was hijacked by Mick and Benoit Hogue.
Yeah.
And they did the Mick and Benny show.
Yeah.
And they were just talking about what Ontario, the difference between Ontario and Western Canada and
yeah.
Quebec.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious.
Yeah.
It was just hilarious.
Yeah.
So,
and
no.
it's funny you mentioned Quebec because the X factor in that 90 team was Mark Bergevin.
Yeah. who is a, I mean, a well-known personality, yeah, aside from having an amazing career.
Right.
Just the way he is as a person. Everyone says how funny he is and how personable and but everything else. So.
He was the one,
yeah,
with his play on the ice,
yeah,
and his demeanor off the ice.
Mm-hmm.
He kept it light.
Yeah.
He was a team guy, and that team won because of him, and then they won the next year.
Yeah.
We got him back in a trade with the Capital District Islanders,
mm-hmm,
back to Springfield, and they won again with him. And he was the one in 90. We were going from Hershey to Baltimore or vice versa. But we were making that trip, and we thought we had clinched, but we weren't sure. We were doing the math in the front of the bus.
Yeah.
Jimmy, Bruce Landon, Pete Cooney, and myself. We couldn't figure out the magic number. We couldn't figure it out. We clinched a playoff spot or not. New Haven was up in Sherbrooke. We either win or lose or tie or something. We're trying to figure it. And Bergie figured it out. And he came up and says, "We made the playoff. We made the playoff." And we're like, "What?"
Yeah.
He goes, "Yes, I did it. You people are stupid." And so no wonder he's a GM, right? So we should have known that. Yeah.
Oh man, John, this has been amazing.
Me too,
this
Joe.
Is this
fun.
Is everything that I hoped it would be. I mean, this is. I could listen to you talk for hours. The stories you have are just gold. I can't thank you enough. I really appreciate
thank
the time.
My
so
pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you, John. And that's it, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Have a great day.